podcast where I talk to myself on a train. Today we're going to be talking about nightcore, a music genre that is apparently made by taking an existing song and speeding it up and pitching it up. Note that this is also the first train hot dog that was recorded after the repairs done to the Transbay tube over Labor Day weekend. So the Transbay tunnel should be a little bit quieter. Maybe you can write in and let what the result was. So before we get into nightcore, let's do rider mail. So this rider mail comes from me scrolling down to find it for a while because I don't know where it is or when it is. It's not yet. Okay, here we go. This rider mail comes from the 575 area code. I actually have no idea where that is. This writer says, "Hi, Brett something somewhere to watch out for Sparkles, Danger Sparkles Meyer, to bring Machinist. I can guessing you love one another or something well already. Have a good day." You have a good day too, Brett something somewhere. I'm not sure, are you talking about the Christian Bale movie The Machinist? Because I like that one. Maybe write in and explain yourself. And we also have a writer mail from Zach Johnson. Zach Johnson says, "Server error in / publisher application. The wait operation timed out. Description, an unhandled exception occurred during the execution of the current web request. Please review the stack trace for more information about the error and where it originated in the code. Exception details, system.componentModel.win32exception:, the wait operation timed out. Source error, an unhandled exception was generated during the execution of the current web request. Information regarding the origin and location of the exception can be identified using the exception stack trace below. Stack trace, :Win32Exception:0x8000405:, the wait operation timed out, :SQL Exception:0x8013:1904:, timeout expired. The timeout period elapsed prior to completion of the operation, or the server is not responding, System.data.sqlclient.sqlconnection.onError, :SQL Exception:Exception, Boolean break connection, :Action:Tick1, wrap close in action, +392. System.data.sqlclient.tdsparser.throwException:warning, :TDSParserStateObjects:stateObj, Boolean caller has connection lock, Boolean async close, +815. System.data.sqlclient.tdsparser.tryrun, run behavior, SQL command, command handler, SQL data reader, data stream, bulk copy simple request result set, bulk copy handler, TDS parser, state object, Boolean ampersand data ready, +415. System.data.sqlclient.sqldatareader.tryconsumemetadata:(+61). System.data.sqlclient.sqldatareader.get_metadata:(+138). System.data.sqlclient.sqlcommand.finishExecuteReader:(+SQL Data Reader DS), run behavior, reset option string, +673.8869. That offset seems crazy. Is this like a split method that exists across megabytes? Like, it's like a German sentence where the verb is split in half, and like one half goes to the beginning of the sentence, the one half goes to the end of the sentence, and like in this method, half of it goes to the beginning of the program and half of it goes to the end of the program. That must be what's happening. This program is written in German. System.data.sqlclient.sqlcommand.runExecuteReaderTDS:(+command behavior, comma, run behavior, run behavior, comma, boolean, return stream, comma, boolean, async, comma, int32, timeout, comma, task, ampersand, task, comma, boolean, async, write, comma, SQL data reader DS, open close parenthesis, plus 6741487. That's the same. That's a similarly ridiculous offset. System.data.sqlclient.sqlcommand.run execute reader open parenthesis command behavior comma run behavior comma boolean return stream string method comma task completion source tick one. Is the tick one like a munging thing like whatever they do to turn C++ identifiers into C identifiers? I feel like it must be like, or maybe another analogy would be long file names in DOS. Completion, comma, int32 timeout, comma, task, ampersand, task, comma, boolean, async, write, close parenthesis, plus 586. System.data.sqlclient.sqlcommand.run execute reader, open parenthesis, command behavior, comma, run behavior, comma, boolean, return stream, comma, string method, close parenthesis, plus 107. System.data.sqlclient.sqlcommand.executeReader, open parenthesis, command behavior, behavior, comma, string method, close parenthesis, plus 288. System.data.sqlclient.sqlcommand.executeDBDataReader, open parenthesis, command behavior, behavior, close parenthesis, plus 180. This is some architecture astronaut bullshit, you guys. This API design is terrible. I'm just saying. PodTrack, oh, here we go. Now it's getting into actual application code. PodTrack.utility.databaseUtility.query, open parenthesis, string command text, comma, iDictionary tick 2 parameters, comma, iDictionary tick 2 output parameters, comma, iDictionary tick 2 column map, comma, command type, comma, nullable tick 1. Maybe that's a template thing. I lost my place. Nullable tick 1, command timeout, comma, string connection name, close parenthesis, plus 486. PodTrack.model at episode summary dot get episode summary list for publisher, open parenthesis, int32, podcaster ID, comma, string type, comma, int32 page, comma, int32 page size, comma, boolean, ampersand more pages, close parenthesis, plus 389. PodTrack.web.www.publisher.controllers.podcastscontroller.index, open parenthesis, encryptable podcaster ID, close parenthesis, plus 458, lambda underscore method, open parenthesis, closure, comma, controller base, comma, object, open close bracket, close parenthesis, plus 171, system.web, okay, now we're back into system code, system.web.mvc.reflectedActionDescriptor. Reflected action descriptor, that's like the least descriptive identifier name I've ever seen in my life, that execute, open parenthesis, controller context, comma, iDictionary tick 2, parameters, close parenthesis, plus 274, system.web.mvc.controllerActionInvoker, another good one, dot invoke action method, open parenthesis, controller context, comma, action descriptor, comma, iDictionary tick 2, parameters, close parenthesis, plus 39. Oof, oh, this is good. Now we're getting into template material. System.web.mvc.async. Open close angle bracket, C underscore underscore display class 39. Dot open angle bracket, begin invoke action method with filters, close bracket, close angle bracket, B underscore underscore 33, open close parenthesis, plus 120. System.web.mvc.async. Open close angle bracket C underscore underscore display class 4F dot open angle bracket invoke method invoke action method filter asynchronously close angle bracket B underscore underscore 49 open close parenthesis plus 452 system.web.mvc.async dot open close angle bracket C underscore underscore display class 37 dot open angle bracket, begin invoke action method with filters, close angle bracket, B underscore underscore 36, open parenthesis, I async result, async result, close parenthesis, plus 15. 4.0.30319.34249. Well, thank you, Zach Johnson, for that delightful rider mail. Maybe you can send back another one and summarize it later. We're going to look up Nightcore. Nightcore, Just a Dream, YouTube. Nightcore Forever Project for Nightcore creators who can find on Facebook. And here's a bunch of videos of, like, anime babes. Boom anime babes. Nightcore Headphones, YouTube. Urban Dictionary, there's a definition. Nightcore. The type of music that started as a subgenre of dance and is still considered so by many people. Trance fans usually call is happy hardcore. Or to not be associated with trance, and don't like the idea of naming a nightcore as anything else. So I just want to stop here and say this definition of nightcore is considered the top definition on Urban Dictionary by Urban Dictionary users. The first paragraph does not say anything about what it is. Alright. Paragraph 2. Nightcore is characterized by a sped-up melody, sometimes fast rhythmic beat usually, and always higher than normal pitch. Always in caps. Almost all nightcore music are original songs nightcored, remixed into nightcore, by nightcore fans. Very popular is a belief that nightcore is a nickname of a person who merely remixes the songs. In reality, anyone who knows how to use a computer can nightcore a song and upload it to YouTube. Quote, do you like trance? No. So why do you listen to it all the time? I don't. But even right now, you're listening to happy hardcore. It's called Nightcore. And that was a definition by Nightcore Fan on June 18th, 2010. Nightcore, I know your meme. hardcore is the glorified term to describe the style of speeding up Eurodance, hands up, and trance emerged in the mid-2000s on YouTube. It is characterized by a tempo of between 160 and 180 beats per minute with high-pitched vocal. It was originated by the Norwegian DJ duo of the same name back in 2002. So wait, the Norwegian DJ duo had the name Norwegian DJ duo? Since 2011, Nightcore has been also massively misused to describe sped-up versions of music, various music genres. That's right, know your meme. There's no such thing as language evolving. Everybody but you is just grown. Origin. In 2002, Norwegian student Thomas S. Neil, I'm not going to try to pronounce this, aka DJ TNT, and Stefan Holt, aka DJ SOS, both were born in 1986 in north of Norway. Started off in the first track for a school project. There are six sources for this. Wait, no. Five sources. They're numbered 1, 2, 3, 5, and 6. After being told by the teacher they will score 4+ for one song, is that a lot? I think that might be a lot. I'd have to look up Norway's school system, grading system. They eventually made their first CD Energized, which consisted of 13 tracks, using the software Dance EJ3, and they scored 6 for the project. Oh man, I bet that's it's probably like S ranking in Japan. Thomas S. Neil, and Stefan somebody used the duo name Nightcore. Oh, that's the nickname that I was talking about, but it didn't exist. Nightcore means that we are the core of the night, so you'll dance all night long. After their first CD release in 2, Nightcore used more advanced software and released 4 more albums. And the CDs were given to local DJs and whoever interested. So, the real question, the burning question, that is most important that I get to, now that we've covered the basics, is there a Nightcore version of the Nightcore theme? Nightcore, Night Court. Lord Tennis Court, Nightcore. Nightcore Tennis Court, YouTube. Nightcore Wikipedia. Oh, yes. Nightcore, Night Court on YouTube. You won't be able to hear it, but I'm gonna listen to this for a little bit. Yep, this is sped up to like 160 BPM. And it's with higher pitched vocals. So, yeah, someone did that. Alright, let's just look up Night Court now. Night Court. Night Court, Wikipedia. Night Court is an American television situation comedy that aired on NBC from January 4th, 1984. To May 31st, 1992. The setting was the night shift of a Manhattan municipal court presided over by a young unorthodox judge, Harold T. Harry Stone, played by Harry Anderson. The series was created by comedy writer Reinhold Weege, who had previously worked on Barney Miller in the 70s and early 80s. Night Court, according to the first season DVD, was created without comedian-magician Harry Anderson in mind, but Anderson auditioned with the claim that he was Harry Stone. Anderson had developed a following with his performances on Saturday Night Live and made several successful appearances as con man Harry the Hat on another NBC sitcom, Cheers. For the first several years of his run, Night Court aired on NBC Thursday nights after Cheers, which had moved to the time slot before Night Court to accommodate the new series, which started them as a mid-season replacement in January 1984. In later seasons, while Anderson remained a key figure, John Larroquette became a breakout personality, winning a number of awards and many fans for his performance as lecherous Dan Fielding. The comedy style on Night Court changed as the series progressed. During its initial seasons, the show was often compared to Barney Miller. In addition to being created by a writer of that show, Night Court, like Barney Miller, was set in New York City, featured quirky, often dry humor, and dealt with a staff who tried to cope with a parade of eccentric, often neurotic criminals and complainants. Furthering this comparison, these characters were routinely played by character actors who made frequent guest appearances on Barney Miller, including Stanley Brock, Philip Sterling, Peggy Pope, and Alex Hantelhoff. While the characters appearing in the courtroom and the nature of their transitions were often whimsical, bizarre, or humorously inept, the show initially took place in the real world. In an early review of the show, Time magazine called Night Court, with its emphasis on non-glamorous, non-violent, petty crime, the most realistic law show on the air. Gradually, however, Night Court abandoned its initial real-world setting and changed to what could best be described as broad, almost slapstick comedy. Logic and realism were frequently sidelined for more surreal humor, such as having the cartoon character Wile E. Coyote as a defendant, convicting him for harassment of the Roadrunner with an admonition to find a meal by some other means. In the opening episode of season 4, Ventriloquist Dummy talks on his own without Ventriloquist to Dan, only to freak him out and make him shout him back away slowly down the hall. The show featured several defendants who appeared before the court again and again, notably the Wheelers, June and Bob, Brent Spiner. Apparently Brent Spiner played both June and Bob Wheeler, who initially pretended to be stereotypical Hicks from West Virginia, but they were later revealed as Yugoslavians, and at one point even ran a concession stand in the courthouse. When asked by Harry why they claimed West Virginia at first, Bob replies, "I don't know, it was just the first exotic place that popped into my head." The Wheelers were notoriously unlucky and were usually brought in on hilariously pathetic circumstances. Other Star Trek actors to be that had guest spots on Night Court included Robin Curtis from Star Trek III: The Search for Spock, which incidentally John Larroquette and also co-starred in as a Klingon, Nana Visitor of Deep Space Nine, and Patty Edwards as Hank Shannon of Star Trek: The Next Generation, the Dauphin. Every episode of Night Court opens and closes with a jazz-influenced bass-heavy theme tune composed by Jack Elliott, featuring Ernie Watts on saxophone, while featuring video footage of prominent New York City landmarks such as the Brooklyn Bridge and the New York County Courthouse. Night Court's theme has been used in Family Guy episode, featuring former U.S. President Bill Clinton playing saxophone, backed up by Secret Service musicians. Night Court's theme was sampled for the remix to Cameron's 1998 single Horse and Carriage. It was produced by Daryl Digga Branch and featured Big Pun, Charlie Baltimore, Wyclef Jean, and Silk the Shocker. List of Night Court episodes, Nielsen ratings. We could really dig in if we wanted to. DVD releases. They got some complete seasons. There were 9 of them. Oh, there was a Night Court film. Night Court film. Night Court is a 1932 American pre-code crime film directed by W.S. Van Dyke and written by Bayard Vaylor and Lenore Coffey. Pre-code Hollywood. Films made in the pre-code era frequently presented people in sexually suggestive or provocative situations and did not hesitate to display women in scanty attire. In this publicity photo, Dorothy McHale plays a secretary-turned-prostitute in Safe in Hell, a 1931 Warner Brothers film directed by Wayne Moore.
Attention passengers, don't believe his lies. Find the truth about the decay. Thank you.
Directed by William A. Roman, starring Dorothy McHale and Donald Cook, with featured performances by Morgan Wallace, Ralph Harrell, Noble Johnson, and Nina May McKinney. The screenplay by Joseph Jackson and Moet Fulton was based on a play by Houston Branch. Gilda Carlson is a New Orleans prostitute. She is accused of murdering Piet Van Saul, the man responsible for ending her life as a secretary and leading her into prostitution. Her old boyfriend, sailor Carl Erickson, smuggles her safely on Tortuga, an island in the Caribbean from which she cannot be extradited. On the island, Gilda and Carl get married without a clergyman to officiate, and she swears to be faithful to him. After Carl leaves on his ship, Gilda finds herself to be the only white woman in the hotel full of international criminals, all of whom try to seduce her, especially persistent is Bruno, the island's executioner, who steals the money that Carl sends her with the hope that she will think Carl has abandoned her. Van Saal arrives on the island having ditched his wife on the lam with the life insurance money he collected after his death. Bruno gives Gilda a gun to protect herself. When Van Saal attacks her, she kills him. She's put on trial and is about to be acquitted by a sympathetic jury, and Bruno tells her that he will have her arrested for possession of an illegal firearm unless she has sex with him. To foil Bruno's trap, Gilda gives a false confession at her trial, preferring to die than to break her vow to Carl. She is convicted and sent to the gallows. Safe in Hell began filming in September 1931 under the working titles of Lady from New Orleans and Lost Lady, and finished on October 18th. The film was originally scheduled to be directed by Michael Curtiz, then initial casting consideration given to David Manners, Boris Karloff, John Harrington, Montague Love, and Richard Bennett, Lillian Bond, and Barbara Stanwyck were under consideration for the women. By the time of its release, Safe in Hell was labeled as being not for children. Time magazine reviewed it, saying, "Safe in Hell is crude, trife, and sporadically exciting." The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette derided the film as illogical and unintentionally humorous. Miss McHale is too good for the likes of her role, while the villains are acted with self-conscious bestiality and amusing indifference. It is called McKinney's performance. It called McKinney's performance the best thing in the picture. Pre-code Hollywood refers to the era in American film industry between the introduction of sound in the late 1920s and the enforcement of the Motion Picture Production Code, usually labeled inaccurately after 1934, as the Hays Code, censorship guidelines. Although the code was adopted in 1930, oversight was poor and it did not become rigorously enforced until July 1, 1934. Before that date, movie content was restricted more by local law and negotiations between the Studio Relations Committee, SRC, and the major studios, and popular opinion, than the strict adherence to the Hays Code, which was often ignored by Hollywood filmmakers. As a result, films in the late 1920s and early 1930s include sexual innuendo, miscegenation, profanity, illegal drug use, promiscuity, prostitution, infidelity, abortion, intense violence, and homosexuality. Strong women dominated such films as Female, Babyface, and Redheaded Woman. Gangsters in films like The Public Enemy, Little Caesar, and Scarface were seen by many as heroic rather than evil. Along with featuring stronger female characters, films examined female subject matters that would not be revisited until decades later in American films. Nefarious characters were seen to profit from their deeds, in some cases without significant repercussions, and drug use was the topic of several films. Many of Hollywood's biggest stars, such as Clark Gable, Barbara Stanwyck, and Edward G. Robinson, got their start in the era. Other stars who excelled during this period, however, like Ruth Chatterton, who decamped to England, and Warren William, the so-called King of Pre-Code, who died in 1948, would wind up essentially forgotten by the general public within a generation. Beginning in late 1933 and escalating throughout the first half of 1934, American Roman Catholics launched a campaign against what they deemed the immorality of American cinema. This plus a potential government takeover of film censorship and social research seeming to indicate that the movies which were seen to be immoral could promote bad behavior was enough pressure to force the studios to capitulate to greater oversight. In 1922, after some risque films and a series of off-screen scandals involving Hollywood stars, the studios enlisted the Beacon of Rectitude and Presbyterian elder William. Speaking of rectitude, is that sarcastic? I can't tell. It's not usually in Wikipedia's tone. And Presbyterian elder William H. Will Hays to rehabilitate Hollywood's image. Hays, later nicknamed the Motion Picture Czar, was paid the then lavish sum of $100,000 a year, equivalent to more than $1.4 million in 2014 dollars. Hays, Postmaster General under Warren G. Harding and former head of the Republican National Committee, served for 25 years as president of the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America, MPPDA, where he defended the industry from attacks, recited soothing nostrums, and negotiated treaties to cease hostilities. From Latin nostrum, ours, nominative neuter of noster, ours.
Passenger is currently on a Barclays hold. Soon as the police clear this train, we can resume normal movement. Thank you for your patience.
A medicine nostrum, a medicine or a remedy in conventional use which has not been proven to have any desirable medical effects. An ineffective but favorite remedy from a problem, usually involving political action.
Alright, passenger, doors now closing. Please stay clear. The doors are now closing.
The code sought not only to determine what could be portrayed on screen, but also to promote traditional values. Sexual relations outside of marriage could not be portrayed as attractive and beautiful, presented in a way that might arouse passion, nor be made to seem right and permissible. All criminal action had to be punished, and neither the crime nor the criminal could elicit sympathy from the audience. Authority figures had to be treated respectfully. The clergy could not be portrayed as comic characters or villains. Under some circumstances, politicians, police officers, and judges could be blind, as long as it was clear they were the exception to the rule. The entire document contained Catholic undertones. It stated that art must be handled carefully because of the morally even its effects, and because its deep moral significance was unquestionable. Catholic influence on the code was initially kept secret. The recurring theme was throughout the audience feels sure that evil is wrong and good is right. The code contained an addendum commonly referred to as the advertising code, which regulated a film advertising copy and imagery. On February 1930, Variety published the entire contents of the code and predicted that the state film censorship boards would soon become obsolete. However, the man obligated to enforce the code, Jason Joy, who was head of committee until 1932, and his successor, Director James Wingate, were generally ineffective. The very first film the office reviewed, The Blue Angel, which was passed by Joy without revision, was considered indecent by a California censor. Although there were several instances where Joy negotiated cuts from films, and there were indeed definite, albeit loose, constraints, a significant amount of lurid material made it onto the screen. Joy had to review 500 films a year using a small staff and little power. The Hays office did not have the authority to order studios to remove material from a film in 1930, instead working by reasoning and sometimes pleading with them. The complicated matter of the appeals process ultimately put the responsibility for making the final decisions in the hands of the studios themselves. One factor in ignoring the code was the fact that some found such censorship prudish. This was a period in which the Victorian era was sometimes ridiculed for being naive and backward. When the code was announced, The Nation, a liberal periodical, attacked it. The publication stated that if crime were never presented in a sympathetic light, then taken literally, law and justice would become the same. Therefore, events such as the Boston Tea Party could not be portrayed. And if clergy were always to be presented positively, then hypocrisy could not be examined either. The outlook agreed, and unlike Variety, predicted from the beginning, the code would be difficult to enforce. Additionally, the Great Depression of the 1930s led many studios to seek income by anywhere possible. As films containing racy and violent content resulted in high ticket sales, it seemed reasonable to continue producing such films. Soon, the flouting of the code became an open secret. In 1931, The Hollywood Reporter mocked the code, and Variety followed suit in 1933. In the same year as the Variety article, a noted screenwriter stated that the Hays moral code is not even a joke anymore, it's just a memory. As films featuring prurient elements performed well at the box office, after the crackdown on crime films, Hollywood increased its production of pictures featuring the seven deadly sins. In 1932, Warner Brothers formed an official policy decreeing that 2 out of 5 stories should be hot, and nearly all films could benefit by adding something having to do with ginger. Filmmakers began putting in overly suggestive material they knew would never reach theaters in hopes that lesser offenses could survive the cutting room floor. Mae West was known to employ this tactic. MGM screenwriter Donald Ogden Stewart said that Joy and Wingate wouldn't want to take out too much, so you would give them 5 things to take out to satisfy the Hays office, and you can get away with murder with what they left in. Films such as Laughing Sinners, Safe in Hell, The Devil is Driving, Merrily We Go to Hell, Laughter in Hell, The Road to Ruin were provocative in their mere titles. Studios marketed their films, sometimes dishonestly, by inventing suggestive taglines and lurid titles, even going so far as to hold in-house contests for thinking of provocative titles for screenplays. Commonly labeled sex films by the censors, these pictures offended taste in more categories than just sexuality. According to a Variety analysis of 440 pictures produced in 1932-33, 352 had some sex slant, 145 possessing questionable sequences, and 44 being critically sexual. Variety summarized that over 80% of the world's cheap picture output was flavored with bedroom essence. Attempts to create films for adults only, dubbed pinking. Pinking, okay. Round up, bringing large audiences of all ages to cinemas. Posters and publicity photos were often tantalizing. Women appeared in photos, in poses and garb not even glimpsed in the films themselves. In some cases, actresses with small parts of films appeared scantily clad. Hays became outraged at the steamy pictures circulating in newspapers around the country. The original Hays Code contained an often ignored note about advertising imagery, but he wrote an entirely new advertising screed in the style of Ten Commandments that contained a set of 12 prohibitions. The first set addressed the imagery. They prohibited women in undergarments, women raising their skirts, suggested poses, kissing, necking, and other suggested material. The last five concerned advertising copy and prohibited misrepresentation of the film's contents, salacious copy, and the word courtesan. Studios found their way around the restrictions and published increasingly racy imagery. Ultimately, this backfired in 1934 when a billboard in Philadelphia was placed outside the home of Cardinal Dennis Dougherty. Severely offended, Dougherty took his revenge by helping to launch the motion picture boycott, which would later result in the enforcement of the code. A commonly repeated theme by those supporting censorship and one mentioned in the code itself was the notion that come here needed to be saved from themselves by the more refined cultural elite. Despite the obvious attempts to appeal to red-blooded American male, most of the patrons of sex pictures were female. Variety squarely blamed women for the increase in vice pictures. Quote, women are responsible for the ever-increasing public taste sensationalism and sexy stuff. Women who make up the bulk of picture audiences are also the majority reader of tabloids, scandal sheets, flashy magazines, and erotic books. The mind of the average man seems wholesome in comparison. Women love dirt. Nothing shocks them. Pre-code female audiences like to indulge in the carnal lifestyles of mistresses and adulteresses while at the same time taking joy in their usually inevitable downfall in the closing scenes of the picture. While gangster films were blamed to corrupt the morals of young boys, the vice films were blamed for threatening the purity of adolescent women. Jean Harlow was described in the Encyclopedia of Hollywood as the reigning sex symbol of the 1930s. Harlow was propelled to stardom in pre-code films such as Platinum Blonde, Red Dust, and Red-Headed Woman. Pre-code Hollywood sex film became synonymous with women's pictures. Daryl F. Zanuck once told Wingate that he was ordered by Warner Brothers' New York Harbor office to reserve 20% of the studio's output for women's pictures, which inevitably means sex pictures. Vice films typically tacked on endings where the most sinful characters are either punished or redeemed. Vice films explore code-defined subjects in an unapologetic manner with the premise that an end-real moment could redeem all that had gone before. The concept of marriage was often tested in terms of the prodigal, in which the woman is having an affair with a seedy character and later falls in love with her brother-in-law. When her mother-in-law steps in at the end of the film, it's to encourage one son to grant his wife a divorce so she can marry his brother, with whom she is obviously in love. The older woman proclaims the message of the film in the line near the end, "This is the 20th century, go out into the world and get what happiness you can." In Madame Satan, 1930, adultery is explicitly condoned, used as a sign for a wife that she needs to act in a more enticing way to maintain her husband's interests. In Secrets, 1933, a husband admits to serial adultery, only this time he repents, and the marriage is saved. The films took aim at what was already a damaged institution. During the Great Depression, relations between spouses often deteriorated due to financial strain, marriages lessened, husbands abandoned their families in increased numbers. Marriage rates continually declined in the 1930s, finally rising in 1934, the final year of the pre-code era, and the divorce rates lowered. This is likely because desertion was a more likely method of separation. Consequently, female characters such as Ruth Shatterson's female with promiscuous bachelorette lifestyles and control their own financial destiny, Shatterson supervise an auto factory without regret. Okay. So I'm here. I need to stop doing this. I will talk to you guys next week.